You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me.
Welcome back to the podcast. We're reading Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Heidegger, and we're on section, do you know what section we're on? 58.
Yeah, we left it at like a cliffhanger, so.
That's right, there's a cliffhanger, what's going to come next.
So
maybe you want to read from Two Calculations, Speed and the Message.
Yeah, well, and just to back up, the section is 58, the three ways the abandonment by being cloaks itself, what they are and how they appear. One is calculation, two is speed, three is the burgeoning of the massive. And then we have apparently more.
yeah, he goes on. So originally he said there were three, but now he's gonna go into four, five, and six. Okay.
To calculation, speed, and the massive, there comes to be allied something further which is related to all three and takes over in an emphatic way the disguising and cloaking of the inner disintegration. This is four. The denuding, the making public and common of every disposition. To the devastation this creates, there correspond both the greater lack of genuineness in every attitude and, as one with that, the debilitation of words. A word is then merely a sound and a noisy excitation in which a meaning can no longer be intended, because every concentration of possible meditation has been taken away, and meditation is altogether disdained as something strange and impotent. All this becomes so much more uncanny the less obtrusively it plays out and the more self-evidently it takes possession of the everyday and is, so to speak, covered over by new institutional forms. The consequence of the denuding of the dispositions. The consequences of the denuding of the dispositions, which is at the same time a cloaking of the expanding emptiness, appear ultimately and precisely in the incapacity to experience what is genuinely happening, the abandonment by being as a disposing plight. Presuming this abandonment could indeed, within certain limits, be shown.
Yeah.
What?
Any comments?
What do you mean?
I don't know. Like on what we just read. I mean, it's weird. I, as you were reading it, I was feeling a little bit like this is the. This feels like, you know, you never quite know if he's like condemning what he's talking about, like looking down on it and explicating it as a degradation of what should be, which was very common in the 20th century among so-called modernists. And I mean, if he's doing that, this kind of feels like maybe the most kind of transparent, or maybe, I don't know, the word I guess comes to mind is shallow kind of criticism. I don't know, like, it just seems like he's kind of saying that dispositions become public, and this is a devastation, words are degraded. I don't know, it seems like he's kind of just like dissing on popular culture or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, at the same time, I think what I often like about him is that it could be a criticism here of just kind of like the shallowness of contemporary life. But at the same time, I think he's actually just giving a taxonomy of what the world is like that is abandoned by being.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if he's necessarily judging it. I think he's just saying that, you know, such is the world when abandonment by being is predominant. And it rings home. It rings true to me what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
I get that, but it sometimes just feels like an old guy complaining about the world. I don't know. Do you get any of that?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, you haven't done your read through it and explaining it. You don't want to read it through. You feel like it's just obvious.
I mean, it seems kind of obvious.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, so every disposition, so essentially moods, positions, attitudes, approaches, inner directions, inner intentions are all made public, and they become common, which I guess is supposed to be juxtaposed to being more private and maybe mysterious and maybe not even fully understood by the haver. To the devastation this creates, so apparently the denuding of dispositions creates devastation, there correspond both the greater lack of genuineness in every attitude, so attitudes become less genuine and they become more public and common, and as one with that, the debilitation of words. Yeah, it smells a little like theatrical prejudice, anti-theatrical prejudice, rather.
It also reminds me of I forgot.
That's okay, you'll remember.
You keep talking.
I mean, I think, you know, Heidegger was a philosopher. Heidegger was a pretty...
I remember now.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I was just listening to a few episodes ago, and we talked a lot about sort of how psychology, philosophy, how it's really tied into these either or questions as if there's a decision being made there. And I don't know, it makes me think a little of that, and that it's like, well, maybe when he's saying of every disposition, he's really the making public and common. Maybe he's talking somewhat about like those fields of like psychology, anthropology. I mean, all the fields, I guess, practically. It's one.
Yeah. I mean, I hate to bring it up so early, but you're right. There's a sort of a liberalism thing going on here. I mean, in the sense that like the, how should we say, the popularization of the social sciences, the commodification of, and I would say kind of the professionalization of psychology and philosophy and journalism and you know, the collegial perspective, where, you know, I mean...
Well, then he says institutional forms too.
Yeah, so it's interesting.
Really,
it's interesting. I think we forget how, or don't quite, because we've become so used to it, how standardized and institutionalized and professionalized and in a sense made public and common all the arts and sciences and humanities have become because of universities.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've had this kind of over the last 100 years giant sucking sound where sort of every intellectual has gravitated into the universities and become licensed and professionalized and departmentalized. And I think there might be something that he's talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
And as we're seeing now, you know, with that level of professionalization and institutionalization, which is also like a great deal of money, you know, I guess things get a little routinized and they become very cherished and defended as positions. Mm-hmm. Is that?
Yeah, totally.
I mean, I think in terms of a critique of liberalism, I mean, you couldn't, for me, hit a more direct bullseye than to kind of talk about the homogenization of the American intellectual by mm-hmm. the universities, mm-hmm. which feels a little like what he's talking about here. I mean, he's also talking about other things, but I was just kind of riffing off your point about philosophy and psychology. Is that right?
Yeah.
And this debilitation of words, mm-hmm. A word isn't merely a sound and a noisy excitation in which a meaning can no longer be intended because every concentration of possible meditation has been taken away and meditation is altogether disdained as something strange and impotent. I mean, I'm tasting hints of the Beats and Allen Ginsberg and Dadaism and James Joyce and the barbaric yawp and words as just, and also the language poets. I mean, the kind of degradation of language, I guess. I don't know if that's right. I don't know if it is a degradation of language. I don't know how they're related. I don't know. Do you have anything to say about that last part?
No.
All this becomes so much more uncanny the less obtrusively it plays out and the more self-evidently it takes possession of the everyday and is, so to speak, covered over by new institutional forms. I mean, you could also be talking about journalism here and just like...
I was thinking journalism.
How the written word has become just kind of tokens of clicks. The consequences of the denuding of the disposition... It's interesting he uses the word denuding, huh? I mean, I guess what he means is that the disposition is no longer clothed, which is at the same time...
Wait, is denude mean...
Yeah, I mean, denude is a weird word. I think it means a number of things. I mean, I think it kind of... It means to strip something of its covering, make it bare, yeah.
Okay.
It doesn't mean to make it unnude.
Yeah.
It sounds like that, but...
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, denuding.
I mean, denude also means kind of like stripped of something. So, like, the forest was denuded of animals. Mm-hmm. So, the denuding of the disposition also just means kind of like the hollowing out of it. Mm-hmm. Consequences of the denuding of the dispositions, which is at the same time a cloaking of the expanding emptiness. So it hides how much it is an expanding emptiness, appear ultimately and precisely in the capacity to experience what is genuinely happening, the abandonment by being as a disposing plight, presuming this abandonment could indeed within certain limits be shown. So, you know, I guess the denuding of the disposition keeps us from being able to genuinely see that the abandonment by being is happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Again, it feels very much like the liberal intellectual order, I guess, I would say. Like, I don't quite have words to expound on what he says, but it feels to me like a little bit of a description of what I experience when I encounter the liberal intellectual order.
Mm-hmm.
A kind of an incapacity to experience what is genuinely happening, an unawareness of the abandonment by being, a cloaking of the expanding emptiness, Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Let's read
should
on.
We do the next one?
Yeah.
5. All these signs of the abandonment by being point to the inception of the era of the complete unquestionableness of all things and of all machinations.
Yeah, well, he just kind of took what we were saying and went there with it. I mean, in other words, all these signs of the abandonment by being point to the inception of the era of the vapid liberal intellectual.
Yeah.
And their machinated, organizational, institutionalized professionalization that is surrounded by money and violence and righteousness. Mm. Yeah.
Not only is it denied in principle that anything could be concealed, more decisively, self-concealment as such is in no way admitted as a determining power.
Yeah, I mean, self-concealment is inimical to liberalism. I mean, because that means you're hiding something, you're not joining the fight, you're not joining the group, you're not opening up, you're obviously holding on to power. You're being entitled, you're maintaining some kind of privilege. I mean, contemporary liberalism demands that you completely reveal yourself and be your identity and hold nothing in reserve, because that means you're trying to maintain power over others.
Yeah. In the era that is completely unquestioning, however, problems will indeed accumulate and will follow one upon the other.
Yeah, and we are in the era that is completely unquestioning. Obviously, we've talked about that.
Yeah.
But the problems will occur in this era. Yeah. Let's see what they are.
Those kinds of questions will accumulate, which are not questions at all, since their answer can be nothing binding. Inasmuch as the answer immediately becomes a new problem. Precisely this claims in advance, there is no problem that is not solvable, and the solution is merely a matter of number applied to time, space, and force.
Yeah, that's just kind of like the predominance of calculation and solvable problems and... Yeah, that makes sense to me, I guess. Yeah,
sure.
All right, go ahead.
6. Now, however, since beings have been abandoned by Bang, there arises an occasion for the most trite sentimentality. Now, for the first time, everything is a matter of lived experience, and all undertakings and affairs drip with lived experiences. And this concern with lived experience proves that now even humans themselves as beings have incurred the loss of their being and have fallen prey to their hunt for lived experiences.
Yeah, you direct. You always talk so eloquently about the lived experience.
Mania.
I don't know.
I mean, I think I've just said in the past that lived experience is very in therapy, is like this idea that it's like a big idea that you should have a lived experience. Is that and about art, I mean stories.
Tell me about lived experience in therapy though.
Well, I'm not sure. You're supposed to live your experience. You're supposed to be in the moment, present. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, also
insightful to say.
I mean, it seems also that when a person presents a history or a memory or an interpretation of their past as their lived experience, so they say something like, you know, I lived this with.
This is how it happened.
This is what happened. This was the experience. I lived it. I know it. Then they immediately, obviously, are telling a massive story that is only one possible narrative strain of their past. but yet in telling it and knowing it and claiming it to be the truth because they lived it, it was their experience, mm-hmm. it is therefore taken as absolutely valid.
Yeah.
Everything is valid.
Yeah.
Valid, it's a big word now, right? Like mm-hmm. you are valid, mm-hmm. meaning your interpretation of what you experienced and how you lived it is completely valid and nobody can argue with that.
Yeah, and I think in general, the therapist is like, validates your story.
Exactly.
It is like, validates your sense of reality.
Right.
I mean, that's another big thing is that like, I think a trend, if my therapist can symbolize a trend, but I've also seen it more places, is just this idea that if their reality is not validated, then it leads to issues, basically, which I can kind of see that.
Well, I
is that
think
different than what you're talking about.
I think you're running into an either or again.
Yeah, yeah. Right? But like, also, I do want to say real quick, I think also when they're talking about that kind of validation, it's more about like in the moment, like when what you're just talking about in terms of validation with the like retelling a story is later. Yeah.
Yes. But also, I mean, take a kid, right? Like if a kid's like, my sister was mean to me because she came up and took the toy, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. I feel hurt and angry about that. Mm-hmm. Now, the validating doctrine would say, absolutely, like you feel hurt and you feel angry and your sister came up and stole the toy. And that makes sense. And I validate your feelings and mm-hmm. you're totally right to feel that way. Right. Mm-hmm. Now the non-validation would be, oh, stop it. Don't feel hurt. Don't feel angry. That's ridiculous. Your sister was just playing. Be quiet. Move on. Right. That's the non-validation.
Yeah. Or like you're not hurt. You're
full of yourself. You're being full of yourself.
Or you being hurt upsets me, the mom.
Right. Like don't be hurt and angry because that's not the right way to be and you're just hurting me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now that's non-validation.
Yeah.
I feel like there's some things in between those two that are interesting and maybe not so dogmatic as being validating uh-huh. or invalidating.
Like what?
Well, you know, oh yeah, your sister came. I mean, because it's all words, right?
Yeah.
So your child says that.
Yeah.
And if you don't deny or tell them they shouldn't feel that way, then you inherently are validating it. You know what I mean? Like, I guess what I'm saying is like validation can be very overt. Mm-hmm. Like where you're like, oh, absolutely, I'm validating mm-hmm. your feelings, and mm-hmm. you're right to feel that way, and that's what you feel, and you should feel that way, and blah blah blah. But the other thing, what you can do is you can take for granted that they feel that way, but you can start to expand their perspective on what went on. Mm-hmm. That maybe there were other things going on, that maybe the lived experience of being hurt and being angry because his sister took the toy, right? Mm-hmm. It is only one way of seeing what happened. Mm-hmm. Say, well, your sister, I mean, so he says, I'm angry, your sister stole my toy. Well, you know, your sister loves you very much and she just thinks everything you do is amazing. And if you touch a toy, that toy becomes a magical golden object and she always wants to play with it. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. You're angry and hurt. Yeah, I mean, I wonder if you could be also kind of flattered or maybe it's fun that sister takes your toy. Like what if I'm holding my toy and you come take my toy? What are you doing? Why are you doing it? Like just mm-hmm. talking to them about what happened mm-hmm. and trying to give them a different take on, I don't know.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, that's super interesting. I think that's really interesting.
It's like my kid once said to me, you know, Hazel once said to me, you know, do we have a religion? You know, what religion are we? Or why don't we have a religion? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I feel like you ripped us off by not giving us a religion. Mm-hmm. Like you failed in not having us have a religion, you know? Mm-hmm. Instead of me being like, oh yeah, you feel really ripped off. You feel really sad. You don't have a religion. I'm validating that feeling. Mm-hmm. Or me being like, oh, shut up. You know, you're lucky I didn't get a religion. Religions mm-hmm. are stupid, blah, blah. You know, I was like, well, are you sure I didn't give you a religion? Mm-hmm. Like, let's ask, what is a religion? Mm-hmm. And well, okay, if a religion is kind of a belief in a power and the love of some community and stuff, like I remember I said to her, I was like, well, you know, I remember we used to walk along and we used to look at the leaves and say, aren't the leaves amazing and pretty? Maybe we were worshiping the leaves. Maybe our religion was walking down the street, you know? So I'm just like,
yeah, yeah.
So I mean, I think there's something between validating and non-validating, yeah. I think.
Yeah, I know, that's very well said. And I think it's so trendy. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think ultimately it comes down to, instead of just this inveterate, incessant, habitual, addictive, professionalized, liberal, validating lived experiences.
Yeah.
Which is really actually just narrative dogma, narrative yeah. propaganda,
yeah.
narrative enforcement.
Yeah, and identity reinforcement.
Yeah, identity inculcation.
Concealment.
Yeah.
We're not concealing.
Instead of being like, yeah, that lived experience, I want to validate your lived experience. I think yeah. it's more about like, well, what did you really live? And what are you really experiencing? And it's about questions, and it's about kind of like, it's about kind of encouraging people not to cling so desperately to lived experience. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Anyhow, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I was just going to say that's really cool because like...
No, I thought you were going to say it was trendy.
Oh, no. No, I wasn't saying you're trendy. Sorry. You're anti-trendy.
I'm not trendy. I'm fighting all my
you're
life
anti-trendy.
To be trendy.
No, no, no. It's when I was starting this by saying just that like I think it's super trendy right now that like... I mean, you even see it on TikTok. This like you've seen those... like the millennial parenting their child and like the kids throwing a tantrum and so like... the mom is like lying on the floor in the middle of the grocery store. Like, I get it. That hurt. Oh my gosh. That's
you
so
mean kind
terrible.
Of like, you mean kind of mimicking or
yeah. Like feeling with him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. Anyways, but I just think it's a huge movement right now, I think.
Yeah.
And I think it's seen as an enlightened reaction to
yeah,
the
of
past.
Course. Of course.
And I think there's also a lot, at least my therapist does definitely, which actually, it sort of the idea that I think what you said is super interesting because I would not have like I hadn't even thought of that, and I was like, and now that our 2.5-year-old is starting to really understand things, it is this like I have to start, you know, when he's upset, which he gets upset about random things, you're just like, oh, okay, what are you supposed to say? I see you're upset. Are you supposed to say that or not? I don't know, but I think you've offered a lot of like some really nice other alternatives because I agree. It also, I think, right. That's what, of course it just never like fully sat well with me. Although I like the idea of it sort of because it's like, okay, so if you're like, I'm upset, I'm mad. And your mom's like, okay, I see you're upset, you're mad. But then you're like, wait, but I don't, maybe I wasn't upset and mad. Maybe I was just like frustrated. I don't know. Maybe it was something else. But then they're like, okay, it's something like it just sort of feels like a labeling of a feeling that
yeah,
isn't necessarily.
That's what I was going to say is I think there's, it's kind of an enforced liberal approach now that if somebody says I'm hurt, you
yeah.
say, yeah, you're hurt. I yeah. get you. I'm validating your hurt. You're
yes.
hurt.
Yeah.
Like you support their identity
yeah.
claim.
Yeah.
And I just want to point out, it's not non-validating to say, oh, well, let's look at that hurt. Like what, are you hurt or are you not mm-hmm. hurt or what part of you is hurt or why does that hurt you mm-hmm. or like it's
yeah.
it's just about interrogate it's because right now I think it's like, oh, if somebody has a feeling, that feeling is an absolute.
Yeah.
as opposed to that feeling is an opening to actually start asking, what are feelings? How do feelings emerge? Yeah. How are we captivated by feelings? Yeah. How are we enslaved by feelings? How are we free with our feelings? How are we our feelings, or how are we not our feelings? There's just a lot to be talked about. Mm-hmm. But in liberal dogma, you don't do that because you're not validating the feeling. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I would say, no, that's not non-validating. Mm-hmm. That's actually just asking questions and trying to broaden the idea of lived experience. Because mm-hmm. I don't think, you know, liberalism's tendency is to say we have a lived experience. Mm-hmm. Whereas I would say we have multiple lived experiences all happening at the same time. Mm-hmm. And we should try to figure out what they all are. And the problem becomes when we say one is predominant over all the others.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's super interesting. My therapist will say to me that, like, my emotions, like, upset my mom. And then it would, like, then she'd get upset. And that was, like, a dynamic. I'm not even saying it's necessarily even me and my mom, but I just sense that this is also a common thing I've seen around. It's just this idea that, like, if the caretaker, I don't know. I'm just curious, like, how you see that fitting in. I guess that's just like, that would just be like kind of in a way the opposite of talking about it, because if the other person reacts by being destabilized by, like, the kid's anger or something. So the kid's angry, the mom gets destabilized and scared by it or something, and is like, I don't know, what's that? I mean, in a way, that's the opposite of being able to sit and talk about it and think about it. I mean, in a way, also, the way that you're talking about sitting and talking about stuff does have a bit of, like, kind of a exposure, ERP, exposure response prevention vibe to it, I think, and that it's not just, I don't know, freaking out about a thing, but it's like sitting with it, talking about it, seeing if what mm-hmm. it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think ultimately part of investigating the difference between validation and non-validation, and part of the quibble I have with the idea that that's an either or, is that it does feel to me like in the adult child dynamic, but I would say in the dynamic between any two people, what I would want if I was on the receiving end of somebody in a position to either validate or non-validate or walk some kind of in between, I want the people in my life to help me not be on the hunt for lived experience.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I would want them to help me broaden and diversify and in a way separate out
mm-hmm, right
the words and the approaches and the reasons and why I'm feeling what I'm feeling. And maybe, and honestly, one of the most exciting things to me would be like, oh, I'm feeling hurt. What I would love is if somebody could help me feel how I might be feeling something quite different than hurt. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean maybe better than hurt, I just mean like, okay, I'm feeling hurt, but why? And what's the feeling behind that? And what are the feelings around that? And what am mm-hmm. what am I striving for by feeling hurt? And it just, you know, there's just a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what he's gonna, I mean, the next section is called Bewitchery in the Era of Complete Unquestionableness. Mm-hmm. And that's what I mean is it's seen, if somebody says I'm hurt and you question that,
mm-hmm.
that's seen as non-validating. But I would say that's not non-validating. That's actually just kind of trying to use someone having a feeling as a starting off point for having a discussion about other things.
Mm-hmm.
related to that and just mm-hmm. trying to broaden and deepen that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it seems that that does go on in, like in therapy too, right? I mean,
definitely. I mean,
feeling,
yes.
But I do think that there's also this an ambivalence because I think you're supposed to just validate.
Mm-hmm.
What about just non-validating? I don't know. Like what's so wrong about that? I don't know. Like I wonder if it's really true that everyone is so super injured
mm-hmm.
by not being validated for their emotions. I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, you're injured by not being validated for your emotions. If you really need to be validated for your emotions, mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. but then why do you need to be validated?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What, where does that need come from? And does everybody just have that need? I mean, it seems to be almost understood that that's a basic human need.
Yeah, I think it's
I'm not sure that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say my dad never really validated my emotions. But I didn't really have a beef with him because of that.
Yeah.
That was just kind of, like, that was kind of interesting. If he had loved me and been fascinated by me and if I felt him craving to be around me and if I felt his admiration for me, that was what I wanted.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I needed his validation of my feelings.
Yeah.
Some people might say those are the same things, but I guess I'm just questioning whether, you know, I think that there's a movement in a lot of people, a very liberal idea that validating other people's feelings is the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me seems like ideology,
mm-hmm.
not science.
Yeah.
Nobody's ever done a study showing that that's the most basic human need.
Well, or they probably have, but who knows how they defined anything.
Well, yeah, I'm sure it was a very impartial study.
Yeah. And then...
It feels like just liberalism trying to make people liberal.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like.
Yeah, right. You're right.
Which is kind of one of the main accusations and critiques I have of liberalism, mm-hmm. is that so much of what they put forward as objective truth... objective human ontological truth
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
is actually just liberalism trying to make sure everybody becomes more liberal.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And so you just feel like you're in this indoctrination chamber.
Yeah, that's very well said.
And so much of it is put forward as, well, but that's, we run the universities. We've done tons of studies. Mm-hmm. We know that emotional validation is the very crux on which a healthy childhood mm-hmm. Hangs.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you don't validate children, they're going to be psycho murderers, mm-hmm. right? I don't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because liberalism has destroyed its own credibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's literally degraded its own reputation via prejudice and bias and propaganda to the point where you can't really believe it.
Yeah.
And secondly, it just feels like, again, a liberal agenda inflicting itself on reality and under the guise of an objective truth.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. That's very well said.
And so it's just, I think it's part and parcel of my just complete alienation from liberalism, like how mm-hmm. utterly alienated I feel from it because it doesn't seem to have really handled very well mm-hmm. the need to maintain its credibility.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's just completely dropped any concern for credibility mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and just become total ideology.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it says it with a straight face. Like it says, these are the truths of the world.
Right.
With a straight face. When you then look at those truths, you catalog them, you say, oh yeah, every single one of these just kind of like is a liberal indoctrination effort.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally like the article I read about how, you know, men need therapy more than ever this article, you know, you hear about this all the time, right? Men really need more, men need therapy more than ever. And because, you know, Trump's been elected and young men are getting into the manosphere and they're starting to watch people like Joe Rogan and, you know, and they really need therapy. And I'm like, is this a serious person? Where we're putting forth the idea of therapy as, you know, these people over here really need it so we can turn them into something that they're not.
Yeah.
Well, then it's like, what do you want to turn them into? Well, we want them to be more like us.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then and so therapy is essentially conversion therapy.
Yeah.
It's, did I make my point?
I think so.
I mean, that's just.
And then I was just thinking, I was like, well, it's kind of like, it doesn't go. Well, I guess it does actually go hand in hand with the idea that men are the problem. The liberal position that men are the problem, so they need to go to therapy to become more liberal.
Yeah, become more like women and become less manly.
Yeah, it does.
Which, you know, again, is just one example, but I mean, I think it's a part of the like idea that something is put forward as just objectively necessary in order to maintain truth, decency, and justice. That people need to be converted, they need to be changed, they need to be convinced, they need to be, blah, 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 under the guise of they are mentally ill or they're astray or they're, you know, getting into bad stuff or they're like, you know, peddling in naughtiness, blah, blah, you know, peddling in ignorance. I mean, and we need to save them from themselves. But yet it's all put forward as like, pure objective human science.
Right.
It's really gross. Anyhow. Yeah.
Let's read more. Good title here, right?
Yeah, bewitchery. 59. I think it's really interesting he uses this word, but go ahead.
Yeah. Bewitchery and the era of complete unquestionableness. We are used to calling the era of civilization the one that has dispelled all bewitchery. And this dispelling seems more probably, indeed uniquely, connected to complete unquestionableness. Yet it is just the reverse. We merely need to know where the bewitchery comes from, namely from the unbridled dominance of machination. When machination attains ultimate dominance, when it pervades everything, then there are no more circumstances whereby the bewitchery can be sensed explicitly and resisted. The hex cast by technology and by its constantly self-surpassing progress is only one sign of this bewitchery that directs everything toward calculation, utility, breeding, manageability, and regulation. Even taste now becomes subject to this regulating and it is entirely a matter of being high class. The average becomes better and better, and thanks to this betterment, the average secures its dominance ever more irresistibly and unobtrusively.
Why don't you just finish the section? There's only two more paragraphs.
Yeah. It would, of course, be illusory to conclude that the higher the average, the more surpassing becomes the height of above average accomplishments. Such a conclusion is itself a revealing sign of how calculation permeates this attitude. The question is whether any space at all is still needed for the above average, or whether satisfaction with averageness does not become ever more reassuring and justified, even to the point of persuading itself that it has already accomplished and could immediately accomplish at will what the above average claims to offer. The constant raising of the average level and the concurrent widening and wide application of this level until it becomes the platform for all activity constitute the most uncanny sign of the vanishing of the decisive places it is a sign of the abandonment by being.
Yeah, that second to last paragraph reminds me of the issue of grade inflation at the elite schools.
I was just thinking that, yeah.
Right?
I feel like we just heard some stat that like it was like 80% of students, 80% of students get A's or something.
I mean, yeah.
It was something crazy.
Yeah, that's at Harvard or something. Yeah.
Yeah, at Harvard.
Yeah, at elite schools, yeah.
No, it totally reminded me of that too.
Yeah, it's I mean, we were just talking about the universities. I mean, it's just, you know, if you were to, it's the kind of thing you would bring up with a liberal and they would just kind of like snuff their nose at it, you know. It's like, but grade inflation at the elite schools is, in my view, you just can't find a more cogent and palpable sign of corruption,
mm-hmm.
cultural yeah. corruption. Yeah. It's just, anyhow, that's a tangent.
Mm-hmm.
We are used to calling the era of civilization the one that has dispelled all bewitchery, and this dispelling seems more probably connected to complete unquestionableness. Yet it is just the reverse.
Wait, hold on. The dispelling is connected. So we think it's dispelled because we're unquestioning?
Yeah. So we are used to calling the era of, so we become, as we become civilized, bewitchery is
supposed to be gone.
Supposed to be gone. And getting rid of bewitchery seems uniquely connected to complete unquestionableness. Yeah, I'm not quite sure where that is. It's like a little strange.
Okay,
yet it's just the reverse. We merely need to know where the bewitchery comes from. Yeah, I mean, I think he's making this, he's saying that, you know, civilization actually, it does not dispel bewitchery, it increases bewitchery.
Right.
And the bewitchery comes from the unbridled dominance of imagination. When imagination attains ultimate dominance, when it pervades everything, then there are no more circumstances whereby the bewitchery can be sensed explicitly and resisted. So the bewitchery goes underground and becomes just a part of the machine. The hex cast by technology and by its constantly self-surpassing progress is only one sign of this bewitchery that directs everything toward calculation, utility, breeding, manageability, and regulation. Even taste now becomes subject to this regulating and is entirely a matter of being high class. High class taste, yes.
Yeah.
The average becomes better and better. And thanks to this betterment, the average secures its dominance ever more resistibly and unobtrusively.
Hmm.
Now, I want to just kind of, I think this word bewitchery is really interesting.
Yeah, I'd like to hear about that.
I mean, I happen to have, I happen to have a colleague in the theater world who's, he is a man and his partner is a woman. And she is very big in the world of witching. She's a witch. She goes on podcasts. She has several books out. Witchery is very hip now.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know this, right?
Yes. Yeah, like being, I mean.
Go ahead.
So there's a semi-competing group of models. Like I have a group and like this other coach has a group and they have like the witchy corner and all this stuff.
Witchy corner is like a hang space on Telegram or something.
It's a topic within a larger Telegram right, exactly. group, but like, it's just that they're like claiming it. I don't know.
What do you tell me about their witchiness? What is their witchiness? What do you think is at the heart of the witch and the bewitching?
Well, I haven't really, let's see. I think they like went to Sedona. They
oh, God,
like,
that's a land of witches.
They like, I think they literally like,
so it's magic and crystals and
a spell together. And
spells.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
anyways,
yeah. I mean,
wait,
I
you have to tell me who this is.
I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
I can tell you off camera. Okay. Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, the cameras aren't on here. No. Whatever, you know, but here's the thing. I just know from his posts and her posts and their whole vibe is that it's very tied up with woman power.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely a kind of reparationist, revisionist approach against the historical, stories of the persecution of witches, mm-hmm. From hundreds of years ago, or whatever. I don't know, maybe witches were persecuted last year. I don't know. Like just the historical persecution of witches, that witches are anti-society, anti-patriarchy, anti-power, that they're secret and magical and alternative, and they represent the power of woman, power of the feminine. But it's interesting. I mean, I think, I have my German text here, but I want to make sure that we are looking at the word bewitchery here in the German.
Mm-hmm.
And what word is he's using now? I think it's hexerei, which is witchcraft, zauberei, which is magic or sorcery, bezaubern. Verzauberung, yeah, Zaubern. It's essentially magic, magic, and now in the world, bewitching is very tied up with females, witches are the female power, and but I think it's interesting because reading this and thinking about her, it's actually witchcraft. Is actually, I mean, first of all, let's be frank. Magic, witches. There's no such thing as a witch, and none of them have magic. Like it's a total right. I mean, can you back me up on this?
Yeah.
I mean, it's totally like Ren Faire shit. It's like fake, right? It's like there's no such thing.
Well, they would claim sort of like manifestation. Manifestation, probably.
That's okay. This is all. Yeah. Okay. So it's.
But yes, you're probably right. I'm just like bewitchery. A little too superstitious to say that.
Yeah. Right. It's bewitchery, and in being bewitchery, it really is the compulsion and the urge to have power over people, isn't it?
Yeah.
To change,
yeah, to be special, to be
well, to change the course of events, to control others, to have power over others through magical means, to use hexes and spells and sorcery and magic to influence others in ways that are secretive and proprietary.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to ask, well, why do you want to do that? Well, because I mean, there's lots of ways to control and influence others, but those ways are hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the woman we met in the park the other day, right?
Mm-hmm.
She said she works at a university. She's an assistant. She's a part-time professor. She also does some administrative work, and she said, oh yeah, I want to get out of professoring and just do administrative because professoring it's just so capitalistic. It's so publish or perish. Mm-hmm. It's so competitive and I'm just not into that. And I thought, well, yeah. And you probably just can't cut it. Like, that's what I thought. I was like, I agree. It's an overwhelmingly competitive environment. It's a competitive space. Everybody's working really hard to be first in it. And so to me, witching is you are retreating from the normal channels of gaining power because you think they're unfair or they're too hard or they're dominated by men or they're not, I don't know, whatever. And you become a witch.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, as much as now I'm going to conclude, witching has been given this real makeover in the last few years, right?
Mm-hmm.
But actually, witching is covert power grab.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's actually completely immoral.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually completely subversive and covert and uncool. Mm-hmm. And of course it's fake and doesn't actually exist. Mm-hmm. So it's really, I'm going to say it. It's like witching is, it's really stupid. It's really stupid. If you identify as a witch and you're like running around being, I'm a witch.
Yeah.
You're not only subversively trying to control other people, yeah, which is, it's hard true. To think. It's hard to think of anything less moral.
Yeah.
And you're being stupid because you're playing a game for that like 4-year-olds play, and you're playing magic tricks, and you're a grown woman.
Yeah.
Anyhow, that's my yeah. diatribe against witchery.
So
I'll probably die. I'll probably die in my sleep tonight. But
how is
so?
How is not all liberalism bewitchery?
Well, liberalism is bewitchery.
Yeah.
Bewitchery and witching are the epicenter of liberalism. They're the ideological yeah. epicenter of liberalism. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, even like, let's say we're going to go and we're going to burn down a Tesla dealership, right? Mm-hmm. Or we're going to punch a Nazi, so-called mm-hmm. Nazi. Or we're gonna shoot a CEO in cold blood on the streets of Manhattan, and become a folk hero, or you know we're just gonna mm-hmm. commit. We're gonna go burn a bunch of buildings down to say Black people matter, mm-hmm. right? That's all just bewitchery. Mm-hmm. And why is it bewitchery? Because it's symbolic. Mm-hmm. And doing things that are symbolic mm-hmm. are done under the guise of magical thinking mm-hmm. and their subtext, their unconscious, how should we say, their kind of their subtext, their intentional subtext mm-hmm. is witchcraft, magic, sorcery, and spell casting. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just now it's done under the spirit of resistance mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and making an example of someone. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, Brian Thompson, was that his name? The
I
CEO,
can't remember, yeah.
the CEO of United Healthcare. He was essentially a living voodoo doll mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. this little witch yeah. bitch, Luigi Mangione, who's a witch bitch.
Yeah.
Fuck that guy forever and ever in hell. He treated a living person just like a voodoo doll or as like a newt or a toad, or he cast a spell through him. Mm-hmm. And the people who are burning Teslas are just casting spells through mm-hmm. this violence. Mm-hmm. People are punching people that they consider Nazis without mm-hmm. any mm-hmm. trial by peers are just, they're casting spells. They're participating in magical thinking, mm-hmm. sorcery, witchcraft.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
That's all.
I was going to say, I'm curious to hear, because I think magical thinking is also a very big thing in intrusive thoughts.
Yeah. How's that?
Well, first of all, it's magical thinking to think that if you think something, it's going to happen or has more likelihood of happening.
Uh huh.
But I think there's also an element of like, oh, if I thought something, so if I had these words, right, which above were very the power of words, or, you know, we've been talking about it, just how sort of dispelled and storied the words are. I guess I don't fully know, but I just think that there's a lot of, or the idea that like if I don't know, you know what I mean? Can you help me?
Yeah. I mean, can you just like say that again? Like recapitulate.
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of magical thinking in anxiety, in terms of, at least for myself, the anxiety is very based in words, sentences, basically catastrophic bad thoughts that are like thoughts, that I then am like, oh, if because I thought that, is it more likely to happen, or do I need to think about it happening?
Right.
I mean, the words are practically spells.
Yes.
And the symbolism of it too is very heavy, because it's like,
yeah,
what's the worst thing? Or like, could, you know, what if I'm a symbol of something? Yeah, well,
that's,
you know?
Okay. Again, that's the bewitchery of liberalism that has infected your mind, because you were raised in that culture.
Yeah.
That words have that power, that words cast spells, that words have an energetic magic to them, that words have independence and autonomy over us, that words are tools to produce intentional results. Mm-hmm. I mean... It's not even, I mean, words can be used dialogically, they can be used argumentatively, they can be used sensationally, they can be used to hurt, they can be used to heal, they can be used to praise. But we're talking about something a little different. We're talking about magic here.
Mm-hmm.
The way words are involved in magic is that if you say abracadabra, calicazam,
right.
Which doesn't mean anything, but there's a magic inherent to that phrase, and then you're going to have a pot of gold outside your door in the morning. So the intentional symmetry between the word and the result, it passes through an imaginary filter of magic outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Now I can say to you, you look great in that dress because I want to take you home from the bar. That's using a word in an intentional, strategic way.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I mean, maybe there's a little magical thinking in that, but actually I would say the reason there's not a lot of magical thinking in that is that one has a reservoir of data that shows that you know, one is constantly strategically using phrases to attain things, and the selection of those phrases as being most likely to attain that thing is strategic, rational thinking, mm-hmm. as opposed to bewitchery, which is abracadabra, calicazam, mm-hmm. and the pot of gold is going to come outside my door.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the use of language without any... Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, witchcraft has zero interest in practical outcomes related to its language, because there are no outcomes from witchery. Witchery is fake. It has no outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just wishful thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you...
Wishful thinking, or...
It's wishful speaking.
Fearful thinking, or yeah.
Yeah, fearful wishing. I don't know. Yeah. And you know, so what I think what we've discovered is that, you know, bewitchery is at the heart of liberalism. And, you know, we see that now with, you know, I mean, what language has become under liberalism. It's become a formalized system of symbols that need to clear headquarters because words can hurt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And so words need to be regulated.
And are important.
Words need to be regulated. And words can hurt because, you know, words can hurt because people... feel words magically. They take the words and they amplify them and they sorcerize them and they bewitch that. They literally bewitch the word and then make themselves the negative target of the hexed, bewitched terminology that then subjects them to an act of victimization, whereby they can then try to control the language. Which is a very witchy intention to begin with, to control the language, to control how people speak, and to control how people think, to control what people want. That is witching par excellence, and that is liberalism par excellence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and as Heidegger says, all this bewitchery gets hidden in machination, which is, again, just liberalism. And And it kind of takes over everything. Yeah. And it becomes the average. Mm-hmm. So it becomes the norm. It becomes the normal. And the average is seen as exceptional.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which is, again, going to Harvard. And you're the exceptional average.
Mm-hmm.
There it is.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, super interesting.
Yeah.
Again, new stuff. It's really cool.
New stuff, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, I think you want to... I would say, like, in terms of anxiety, think about that magical thinking. Think about what words are. Think about how bewitchery and liberalism have given you a perspective on words that is a fantasy and a fairy tale, and as valid as witchery. Mm-hmm. And realize that, you know, to the degree that you give words power over yourself, mm-hmm. power over you, as opposed to you having power over words, mm-hmm. you're setting yourself up to be terrorized by your own thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the crux.
Can you bring that back to... Go ahead.
What?
Parenting.
Well, I was going to say, I think that's the crux in that... Do you tell your children that words have power over them?
Mm,
or do you tell them that they have power over words?
Mm-hmm.
And so by saying that, the child saying, I am hurt, and then you bending over backwards to validate that, you're kind of telling them that word hurt, I am hurt, that identity claim, that identity formula, means that the hurt has power over the I.
Mm-hmm.
You're validating the hurt. And instead... I think that an interesting approach would be to say, well, I don't deny that you're hurt, but I also would like to put forward the idea that you are more powerful than that hurt.
Mm-hmm.
That word hurt doesn't have magical powers over you.
Mm-hmm.
And you can actually dive into that hurt because you are the powerful one, not the hurt,
mm-hmm.
and start to dismantle it and look into it and start to ask, what is it?
Mm-hmm.
Is there fascination? Is there love? Is there despair? Where did that come from? How old am I? When was I born? Where am I? Where do I come from? What am I in? What am I of? Where am I at? How do I be? What's going on? You know, like
mm-hmm.
that hurt is a gateway, but only if you are more powerful than the word.
Mm-hmm.
So all this lived experience, all this validation is really saying that words are more mm-hmm. powerful than you. Words cast spells on you.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never say to my child that words cast spells on you. You know, and it goes back to Leah, you know, Leah, I called you Leah. Whatever. Our dispositions are so undenuded.
Yeah.
The little Christian girl telling you you're going to hell.
I know, yeah.
Okay? It's such a pivotal moment in your life.
Totally.
The Christian girl, you're 9, tells you you're going to hell. You go home, you tell your mom flips out, there's meetings at school, there's meetings with the parents. And your parents' reaction was grounded in this kind of hexerei, which is that word hell.
Right, has power.
Has power over you, and it never should have been uttered in your presence.
Right.
Whereas, and I've said this before, and I think this is an example of how the opposite of validation and witchcraft can be a parenting style,
mm-hmm.
you know, oh, well, whatever, that person's just talking shit and like mm-hmm. move on and hell is nothing, hell doesn't exist.
Yeah.
That person obviously believes in a fairy tale and a bunch of mm-hmm. humbity jumbity mm-hmm. and they're talking nonsense and you shouldn't give them a second.
Mm-hmm.
You're more powerful than that word.
Yeah.
That word means nothing to you. That word it's a stupid little word.
Yeah.
What is that word?
Yeah, totally.
So those are two different approaches.
Yeah.
But you were a little freaked out, I think. or you were confused or whatever, or your parents wanted you to be really freaked out.
Yeah,
they wanted you to have the experience of having had a spell cast on you. Now you're in big trouble.
Yeah.
Because of the witchcraft.
Right.
Because the weird Christian girl in the woods told you you're going to hell. I mean, it's like a grim fairy tale. It is. Right?
Well, she actually said it was H-E-L-L.
Oh, she spelled, that's even better. She spelled
and
it out.
Like I didn't know what witch. It was.
Oh, yeah, see? It's witchcraft.
And I had to ask my parents, what is this?
It's like she spelled it in sticks.
Yeah.
In the dirt.
Blood.
With blood. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah.
All right.
That's really insightful.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.